Good afternoon, folks. This is the Ontolog invited speaker presentation. The date is Thursday, the 27th of June, 2013. Today's speaker is Dr. Vinay Chaudhary from SRI. I'd like to introduce Dr. Vinay Chaudhary. He has been at SRI for quite some time. His focus has been mainly on science and engineering of large knowledge-based systems. It spans knowledge representation and reasoning, deductive question answering, knowledge acquisition, and innovative applications. He's worked on a wide range of knowledge representation and reasoning systems, including Loom, Ontolingua, Psych, KM, and F-Logic. He was also part of the team that developed the Open Knowledge Base Connectivity Protocol for accessing knowledge bases. He's also contributed to storage and multi-user software that underlies SRI's EchoPsych project. Since 2000, he's been working on a system to capture knowledge from science textbooks and answer questions with that knowledge. He's going to speak today on, I guess, that project, which is, the title is called KB Bio 101, Conceptual Modeling Challenges in Creating a Biology Knowledge Base. Thank you, Dr. Chaudhary.
Thank you, Leo. Okay, so Leo has already mentioned the title of the presentation. Just to note that this work is owned by Vulcan, but it's available freely for non-commercial research use under Creative Commons license. And you can see the license by clicking on the link on this front slide. Slide two, please. This work has been done under funding from Vulcan, and I've been fortunate enough to work with a group of fairly talented and capable team whose names are listed here. This work would not have been possible without their contributions. Slide three. So I will start by giving you a short overview of the project, and then we will get into KB Bio 101. I'll talk about the representation and reasoning, the upper ontology, and then representation of structure function, and then conclude with some open research problems. Slide four, please. Yeah, so this is the point where I like to request everybody to play this video. This is a 5-minute video, which you can access by clicking on this link, and it gives a fairly concise overview of our project. So could everybody please click on this and watch this for 5 minutes? So I will be silent, and I'll be speaking again in 5 minutes.
Hi, I'm Jenny, a biology student, and this is my iPad. I'd like to show you Enquire, a new vision for a biology textbook. Like any electronic textbook, Enquire lets me read my book, take notes, look up key terms, and interact with graphics. But Enquire is capable of so much more. It's a textbook that answers questions using an AI reasoning system. It helps me study by suggesting questions and defining terms as I read. It helps me with homework by answering my questions, even the stupid questions I might hesitate to ask in class. I've been reading about plasma membranes, so I might ask questions about their structure, their function, and about the relationship between structure and function. Understanding relationships is crucial to understanding biology, and I can't get answers like these from the book. Linked from the text and from every answer are Enquire's Wikipedia-like glossary pages, which summarize everything I need to know about a concept. Because the AI generates these pages from the knowledge in the book, I'm never overwhelmed with unnecessary details. In addition, Enquire can compute the key differences between any two concepts. Comparing things is an important skill, and Enquire teaches by example. Now that you've seen what Enquire does, let's take a look at how it works.
Enquire combines a curated biology knowledge base and a reasoning system that answers questions. The knowledge base consists of over 5,000 concepts pulled directly from the Campbell Biology textbook. Our team of biologists processes each sentence, extracting the key concepts and authoring conceptual models by drawing graphs. Let's see how this sentence is represented. On the outer surface of the plasma membrane, Carbohydrate side chains are found attached to proteins and lipids. Here's part of the plasma membrane graph. As a type of membrane, it inherits all the parts of membranes, including these specific types of proteins and lipids. The carbohydrate side chains are connected to these glycoproteins and glycolipids using the Has-Part relationship from our ontology. To apply this knowledge to answer a question, we have three steps: question interpretation, reasoning, and answer presentation. Let's look at a question students might ask. What structure of a plasma membrane facilitates cell-cell recognition? First, the student's natural language query is translated into logic, visualized here by a graph. The reasoning engine works backward from this query. From the knowledge base, it finds that all cell-cell recognition events are facilitated by a carbohydrate side chain. Then, in a different part of the knowledge base, it finds that all plasma membranes have a carbohydrate side chain. Thus, it deduces that carbohydrate side chain is the answer. The final step is presenting the answer using the most appropriate visual templates. Related images and sections from the book are linked using statistical text analysis, while follow-up questions are generated from predefined templates using relationships in the knowledge base. Inquire addresses the AI grand challenge of building a knowledge base from a textbook and giving detailed answers to a wide variety of questions. But how do these answers measure up from an educational perspective?
I like Inquire because it helps my students focus and gives them a framework for problem solving and metacognition. I'm not always around to answer their questions, so when students need help, they turn to Google or Wikipedia. If I ask a question about steroid pollutants and dragonfly reproduction, students using Google have to sift through piles of stuff about baseball, bodybuilding, and sex. Inquire is based on our textbook, so it only provides what my students need. It's a bit like a science calculator. Inquire can't do their homework for them, but by answering simpler questions and suggesting follow-ups, Inquire can help students incrementally work toward a solution. In a study, we tested Inquire against both electronic and paper versions of the textbook. Students studied a section of text, completed a homework assignment, and took a quiz. Students using Inquire earned significantly higher scores on the homework and quiz, a full letter grade on average. In addition, no Inquire student got a D or F on the quiz, while nearly a third of the other students did. This suggests Inquire may be especially helpful for lower performing students, which we hope to explore in a future study.
Our system contains the knowledge from a single book, but our approach for representing conceptual knowledge is applicable to a variety of textbooks. Inquire is an example of how AI technology can ensure that the transition to digital textbooks is not just a superficial change, but rather a change that improves learning for students.
Okay, I'm done. Back to you, Vinay.
Okay, so I will start. So I think this video gives a fairly concise overview of our project. And as you can see, you know, there are many different elements going on. You know, there is ontological modeling, there is question answering, there is user interfaces, there is education research, etc. If you go to the next slide. So there are basically two main software artifacts that we built as part of the project. One of them is called Aura, a knowledge authoring environment for domain experts. And then the other one is Inquire, which is the end-user application, which students use as they are reading from the book. So for Inquire, you already saw the demo, and a lot of work that was done for Inquire was primarily designing the user interface and doing the education research to figure out how this capability could be used by end-user students. I have a whole 1 hour talk on just Inquire where we talk about the education research, the experiments that we did. I'm not going to say any more detail about that because that's a completely separate topic. So what I'm going to do is to briefly introduce Aura and then get deeper into the knowledge base and then the technology behind the knowledge base. So could we go to the slide 6, please? So this slide shows the technology architecture of our system. The left half is primarily focused on the encoding technology, and the right half is focused on problem solving and question answering. So we have domain experts who are usually people with a degree in sciences who use our knowledge offering system. We have a fairly extensive set of guidelines using which the knowledge from the textbook is captured. We have a knowledge representational language and a concept library through which from which the knowledge encoding starts. We have, on the problem solving side, we have a fairly extensive set of question answering methods, some of which I'll talk about in the presentation. The question asking is supported through a freeform natural language understanding interface. We are not fully natural language in the sense that many of the natural language templates are mapped, natural language sentences are mapped to templates, which the system understands and is able to answer. Some of the natural language templates are mapped to suggested questions, which are presented to the user as an option, which they can choose if it matches their intended question. So this was just a very quick rundown over various components. Can we go to slide 7, please? So now we are getting deeper into Aura, and the basic philosophy and approach behind Aura is that there is a division of labor between knowledge engineers and biologists. Knowledge engineers are responsible for providing a small library of domain-independent representations. More popularly, this is also referred to as a upper ontology. And the upper ontology that we are using is called a component library, and it contains classes to represent physical actions and a vocabulary of relations. I'll show you a little bit more of this in a later slide. So starting from this upper ontology, the biologist access this and apply this to encode the biology knowledge. And that is done through the graphical editing interface, which is provided through Aura. Again, all of this is previously published work. I'm not going to go more in depth into this, but I've provided here links to papers which give more details about how each of these pieces works. Can we go to slide 8? So yeah, so now we will get into the meat of the current talk, which is KB Bio 101. Let's go to slide 9, please. Okay, so KB Bio 101 is built from a textbook called Campbell Biology, and it's a textbook that is used in advanced placement biology courses in high schools and introductory biology courses in colleges. And that's the source for calling the KB 101. And so basically what that means is that this is a KB which corresponds to the knowledge that a student is supposed to have if they are taking Bio 101. So we had a team of biologists use Aura to curate the KB from the textbook using a fairly sophisticated knowledge authoring process. And I'll also give you some detail on the knowledge authoring process in a minute. And the KB that we have created, it's a valuable asset because a lot of effort has gone into it. Here we are giving, just the estimates of how much effort we have put into this. It's very tricky and difficult to come up with accurate estimates on how much time went into curating the KB, because when you are doing the project, there are a lot of other things going on. There are false starts, there are bugs in the system. You do things and then you throw away things and you start all over again. And so it's very tricky to figure out, exactly how much time it is that you can say was put into the KB. But again, we came up with these numbers based on, okay, if we were to doing this KB based on everything that we know now, and if we were to do it from scratch, this is roughly the effort one would have to put in to create it from scratch. And this does not include any time that was spent in creating the technology, like the Aura or Inquire or education research. None of that time is included in this, 17-person year estimate. That's just an estimate of the effort it took just to encode knowledge. And this KB is now available free of charge for research purposes. I provided here a link to which you can go and download the KB. We are distributing it in standard formats like OWL and First Order Logic and TPTP and SILK and AnswerSet programming. So we are very interested in working with the community to see if they can take a look at this KB, try to use it, and I'll mention towards the end of the talk various research problems that are very interesting in the context of this knowledge base. Can we go to the next slide, please? Before I talk about the actual content of the KB, I thought I should say a few words about the knowledge representation that is used in the KB. So the representation language, which is called KM, it has all the popular and favorite features, like you can define classes, you can do subclasses, you can do multiple inheritance, you can do disjointness. You know, these are features that, you know, all of us know and love. And similarly for relations, you can do domain and range restrictions, you can have transitivity, you can have relation hierarchy, et cetera. So there is nothing surprise, you know, this is, you know, state-of-the-art representation technology. And just to, you know, ground this a bit more, I have an example here of a graph that shows the encoding for every cell is a living entity and has a ribosome and a chromosome part. So in this graph, you will notice that the cell node is white and the other two nodes, ribosome and chromosome, are gray. The reason is the cell node here is universally quantified and the other two nodes are existentially quantified. That's why the color is different. And I'll be using this distinction and notation quite a bit later on in the presentation, so that's why I'm taking a few minutes here to explain this. Now, this graphical notation of the graph can be turned into logic. And first I'm showing here the first order logic notation that for all instances of cell, there exists a living entity and there exists, for all instances of cell, there exists Y1 and Y2 such that X is also a living entity and X has parts Y1 and Y2 such that Y1 is a ribosome and Y2 is a chromosome. Okay, it's a pretty simple, straightforward translation. And at this point, it's also very easy to turn it into a description logic notation, which is shown below that, which is fairly trivial and straightforward. Could we go to the next slide, please? Now, I'm going to explain the unique features. So there are a few things about the representation scheme that we are using which are different and which are not commonly seen in the representation languages. So the first one is that we can represent graph-structured descriptions. So, for example, if you have to encode every eukaryotic cell is a cell and has parts a eukaryotic chromosome, nucleus, and a ribosome such that chromosome is inside the nucleus, you would get a graph structured description of the form which is shown here, which is in logic, which can be seen as the first order logic axiom that is shown just below that. Now, the thing about this representation is that this, unlike the one that I showed on the previous slide, this is no longer tree structured, because the nucleus node has multiple parents, so that violates the tree property. And even though this seems pretty trivial, but the fact is that this knowledge is not expressible in any known decidable description logics, such as OWL2. So we couldn't have used OWL for doing the modeling because the kind of representation pattern that you're seeing here, it comes all over the biology textbook, and you couldn't go very far unless you were supporting these graph-structured representations. This knowledge can, however, be captured in many of the widely available rule languages. Next slide, please. Okay, so this slide, again, it's titled Unique Features, and the other unique feature of the representation we are using is what we call inherit and specialize. So what that means is when defining eukaryotic cell, we want to say that the ribosome, which is part of the eukaryotic cell, was inherited from cell, because all cells have ribosomes, and eukaryotic cell is a subclass of cells, so it must inherit the ribosome. And eukaryotic cell also inherited a chromosome, but that chromosome was specialized into eukaryotic chromosome. So we inherited it, and we then specialized it. So we want to make these relationships in our representation explicit. So how does one do that? Well, the first thing is we have to be able to refer to these nodes in the superclasses. So if you could go to the next slide. So the way you do that is first thing you do is, you know, instead of using existential quantifiers, you turn them into Skolem function. Once they are turned into Skolem functions, you have handle on each of these nodes so that you can talk about them. Okay? And I'm showing here the Skolemized version or Skolemized representations of these two graphs, which has Skolem functions which we can use to refer to these each of these nodes outside the scope of the rule itself. So if you go to the next slide, please. So in this slide, we have added two equality statements. So the one which is in green is corresponding to the statement that ribosome was inherited from cell. So, and you know that we can do that because we have these Skolem functions which can be referred to outside the scope of either of these two axioms. And then the equality statement shown in blue says that chromosome that was inherited from cell is the same as the chromosome which is for eukaryotic cell, which in the context of eukaryotic cell, you've said that it's an instance of a eukaryotic chromosome, okay? So this kind of thing is fairly unusual, and it's definitely not possible in the description logic systems. There are many rule languages that which support functions that will support the support such modeling. Okay, so let's go to the next slide. So this slide is titled Computational Properties. So we have spent some time trying to analyze the computational properties, and since the knowledge is not expressible in any of the description logics, it was pretty straightforward to conclude that while the reasoning is in general undecidable, there are, however, some decidable fragments that will restrict the representation, for example, guardedness or cyclic structure, which make the reasoning decidable, but if you restrict the knowledge to say a cyclic KBs or guarded KBs, you can no longer encode the knowledge that is needed for KB-Bio 101. So KB-Bio 101, if you, the way you get it in its vanilla form, as far as we know, it's undecidable to reason with. And we have a paper on this topic, which is going to appear in ICLP, and you can find the link here and read more about that issue. We've also thrown this problem as a challenge to both the first-order logic and the OWL reasoner communities. And there is a OWL reasoner evaluation workshop coming up later on in July, and the BioKB 101 will be used as one of the user-submitted ontologies in the reasoner evaluation competition. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say about the knowledge representation. So let's go to the next slide, which is titled Knowledge Factory Process. And so basically what the what that is we needed a systematic way of going from the book into the knowledge base. And the goals we were trying to meet was that, first of all, we wanted the process to be systematic so that there are no gaps in the encoding. Because in the early parts of the project, when we were encoding knowledge, we had a frequent complaint that a question doesn't answer, and the answer, and the reason for the question not answering was because, oh, we forgot to encode this knowledge. So we needed a process using which we could make sure that we've encoded everything that needs to be encoded. We also wanted to ensure consensus. You know, even though one would expect that it's a standard textbook and people would agree with the meaning of what is said in the textbook, but in practice, it turns out that is not as straightforward as one would think. And we needed a process using which people who are doing the encoding could agree what the textbook is actually saying and how to actually capture it in the system. And finally, we were interested in systematically identifying what are the things that we cannot do. What are the challenges? And we wanted to have that as a side effect of the process. So can you go to the next slide, please? Just slide 17. So this is just a quick one-slide introduction on our knowledge factory process. Basically, we have six steps in the process. The first step is determining which sentences should be encoded, because not everything in the book is relevant for question answering. The book will have things like historical information, and so which we don't necessarily need to encode. Second step is reaching consensus, where people or the encoders would read the book and they would try to rewrite the meaning of the sentence in their own words. And then next, the encoders would do a planning. Because the book would repeat the information, or it would first introduce a concept and then it would add more detail and then add more detail. For the encoding purposes, it is very helpful to have all the knowledge about a concept in one place. So in the planning phase, people would pull out the knowledge which is spread across a chapter and bring it together before they actually start encoding. Then they would do the encoding. Once the encoding is done, there is a manual inspection quality assurance step. We would evaluate the quality of the representation. That's basically by looking at the representation. And once that step is done, we test the knowledge base by posing questions. We had these huge, huge test suites we would run against the knowledge base and see, you know, which of the questions answered, which of the questions fail, and then we'll go back and fix them. Now, I've shown this KE process as a fairly linear flow. That is purely for pedagogical purposes. That's not how it happens in practice. There is always iteration. Sometimes you are doing the testing and you have to go back and do the encoding. And even when you're doing the encoding, you have to think about what kind of questions you're going to ask. So it's not necessarily as linear a flow as this slide suggests. Okay, let's go to the next slide. So this slide shows the some statistics of the KB101. And it's the result of applying this knowledge factory process to roughly half the book. And we have about 6,400 classes, 455 relations. Average number of scolums per classes is 24. So what that means is that every class in our knowledge base will have a description. So like a graph that I showed you earlier, for example, a graph for eukaryotic cell. And on an average, each class description would have 24 nodes on its graph. Okay, so that just gives you a little bit of sense for the complexity of these graphs. We have a fairly well-developed taxonomy. There are like roughly 6,993 taxonomical axioms, 18,000 disjointness statements, over 100,000 equality assertions, etc. So, and I know I'm using some of the things that are abbreviations like DRAs. DRA is a domain range restriction. These abbreviations are all explained in one of the papers which was cited on two slides ago. So if you read those papers, you know, these numbers start to make more sense. Can we go to the next slide? Okay, so up to this point, you know, I've mostly talked about, you know, the process and the statistics and the KR. And this is really the first slide on the content of the ontological content which exists in the book. And, you know, this is, the ontological content can be organized in these eight major categories, structure and function, regulation, energy transfer, continuity and change, et cetera. And each of these major thematic areas poses a challenge. You have to design the ontology, you have to design the representation, and only then you can do the encoding work that I just explained. And this is the work, you know, which is really the work that has to be done by the knowledge engineers before the encoding could even begin. So for the purpose of this presentation, I've chosen to focus only on structure and function. So for the next half an hour or so, I will go much deeper into structure and function and try to give you a sense for the kind of technical work that had to be done to do the design for this. Next slide, please. Slide 20. Okay, so yeah, we'll talk about structure and function next. Next slide, please. So for doing the design for any of these, the starting point is always, what does a biologist mean by this? What is it, when a biologist says structure and function, what do they mean? So if you read the book will explain this by saying that while structure and function are correlated at all levels of biological organization, for example, if you look at a bird, which is an organism level, the birds have wings which are shaped in an aerodynamic shape, and they are shaped like that because the function of the wings is to support flying. And that's an example that the structure is related to function. And if you look at a lower level of biological organization, which is a bone, if you look at the bones, they have a honeycomb, wing bones in particular. They have a honeycomb structure, and that structure keeps the bones light but also makes them strong. Okay? So, I mean, that's what a biologist would give us. And again, I think the challenge for us is how do we take this and formalize this in a computational manner? So if you go to next slide, slide 22. So we try to, given this biological knowledge, we try to come up with a computational meaning. And we do that by coming up with a set of questions. And you know, in the ontology design, people have talked about competency questions. So the kind of questions that we have are very similar in spirit, and we have two broad categories of competency questions. There are diagnostic questions, and then there are educationally useful questions. And I'll give you examples of both of these kinds of questions in next few slides. The diagnostic questions, you know, they basically assess the knowledge representation. And the educationally useful questions were motivated by the requirements of inquire. And basically what that means is that the question needs to be interesting, like a teacher or a student must be interested in asking such a question. The question should be Google hard in the sense that if the question is such that you could just type it into Google and answer a question, then you don't get an answer, then you don't necessarily need a well-curated KB for answering that question. And the question should not be too hard, because there are some questions which can be fairly open-ended and, you know, they can require open-ended research. So we try to stay away from those questions. So, like, the goal is to identify a sweet spot of questions which are useful, which are interesting, they cannot be done using any other method, but are also technically achievable within a reasonable time frame. So next slide, please. So diagnostic structure and function questions are fairly obvious. What is the structure of X and what is the function of X? Because if the system has knowledge about structure and function, it should be able to answer these two trivial questions about structure and function. And they are purely diagnostic in nature. They have some educational value also, but at times people tell us that, oh, you know, these are too simplistic for educational purposes. So if you go to the next slide. So we also assembled a huge corpus of questions which we gathered from teachers and students. You know, we had a focus group of teachers and students, and we asked them, if you were learning and studying about structure and function, what kind of questions would come up? And we took that corpus of questions, which had over 100 questions, and we grouped them into categories. And the result of that analysis is shown on this slide. And those questions basically fall into five broad categories. So the first one here is relating structure to function. And an example of such a question would be, what structures of biomembrane facilitate its function, namely phagocytosis? Another question category, which is actually my favorite, is the similarity reasoning, which has the general format of A is to B as C is to what? And a specific instance of that question is glucose is to glycogen as ATP is to what? And, you know, it's a form of analogical reasoning, and it really requires a fairly detailed and deep knowledge about the domain to be able to answer these questions well. Next slide, please. So the starting point for doing a design of an ontology for this need was to begin from the upper ontology that we have, which is component library. And component library in Spirit is not very different from many of the other things that you see out there. You know, it has an event hierarchy, an entity hierarchy. It also has roles and properties. I would say one big difference between component library and other major ontologies such as Dolce and BFO and GFO is that CLIBE has a fairly extensive taxonomy of actions. And that was actually fairly critical for this project because we were modeling biological processes and you need a vocabulary, you need a process vocabulary that you could start from. So the CLIBE, the way we used for creating KVBio 101 is available at the link which is shown at the bottom of slide 25. You're welcome to go to this site, browse it, and it will give you a feel for what's in there. Next slide, please. Slide 26. So component library also has a set of relations to describe events. The relations to describe events can be grouped into various categories like event to entity relations, event to event relations, event to value relations. So, for example, the event-to-entity relations, they are largely motivated by case roles and linguistic theory, and we have relations like agent, object, instrument, raw material, result, etc. The event-to-event relations are motivated by the process theory, like what do you need to model the process structure, what do you need to model process causality, etc. All of this work actually existed prior to this project, so, and you can read about this in the CLIBE paper, so I'm not going to say more about this. Next slide, please. Similarly, we have a set of relations which can be used for modeling relations between entities. So we have metonymic relations like has part, has region, spatial relationships like is at, is inside, and the properties. So, I mean, the thing that we had to do was to bridge the gap between what biologists mean by structure and the relations which are supported in the ontology. And what we had to figure out was to determine which of these relations would a biologist consider a structural relation. And it turns out that the metonymic relations and spatial relationships are the ones which biologists tend to consider as structural relationships, whereas things like properties, length and diameter, et cetera, they won't consider that as necessarily as integral a part of structure as the other two categories of relations. Now, you know, that part of the design was pretty straightforward, other than, you know, just, you know, supporting a relation like hash structure in the query language so that when you query using hash structure, you can inference back to any of these lower-level relations to answer the question. The other big problem we faced in using these relations in the encoding process was when to use each of these relations. So, like, for example, when do you say that something is a part of something else versus something is a region versus material or possesses? So that's the piece of work that we had to do to support the encoding. And if you go to the next slide, slide 28. So this slide describes a kind of a flow chart which helps an encoding biologist to figure out which relationship to use. And this is not quite the same as the work that Maria Keech has done, but is partially inspired by the kind of guidelines she talks about in her work. So I'll quickly walk you through how the encoding process works for our project. So for modeling structure, the first thing we ask the biologist to do is that, you know, X has structure Y if it makes sense to say X has Y in English. If you can't say that in English, then Y is not a structure of X. Then the next thing they do is ask themselves if Y is a region which could be defined only in relation to X. And just to make it even easier for biologists, Y is such that it doesn't make sense to associate properties such as mass or density, but it may have things such as length, area, or volume. Now, this is something which in the broader ontology literature has also been referred to as a dependent continuant. So, like, this is an entity which is, depends on the existence of something else, which makes perfect sense to me as an ontologist, but it's very difficult to have that kind of language easily understood by biologists, and that's why we came up with these much simpler guidelines so that it's easier for biologists to use. Okay, and if X is not a region of Y, we ask them to check if X has material Y only if Y is tangible and is pervasive in X. And, you know, this is the object versus stuff distinction which is made in the ontology literature. So, like, what is a material of a table, for example. And next, X has element Y if X is a set of entities of the same type or sibling types that Y is an instance of. So, you know, here examples are like a DNA strand. A DNA strand would have nucleotides as its elements because they are of the same type and they are one and more. And finally, X possesses Y only if Y is energy bond or gradient, which actually is a fairly odd collection of things. But what we found was that the textbook uses the term possesses. It uses a term such as X has energy or X has bond, but we didn't think that any of the previous relations were appropriate. And the biologist would use the possesses relationship for structure. And if none of these relationships apply, then the last relation would be part, and in that case, you know, you could use the relationship X has part Y. I'd say that from the ontology design point of view, this was one of the key creative pieces of work that we did because it's not very difficult to code has part, but coding has part or has region in a manner which is consistent across the book for a variety of entities, that's not very straightforward. And I'll try to give you an example of that in a second. So go to the next slide. So this graph shows the structure of mitochondria. And this is giving you just a taste for how some of these graphs look. Here we show that mitochondria has enzymes, has membranes, mRNA, ribosome, and DNA, and the mitochondrial and the enzyme is inside the mitochondrial matrix. So, you know, we are coding both the part relationship as well as the spatial arrangement of the parts. Strictly speaking, as I said earlier, properties like length, they should not be part of the structure. But sometimes when they are qualitative in nature, like here, length is between a certain range. In those cases, biologists tend to consider the qualitative relationships as part of the structure description. Next slide, slide 30, please. So this is a more tricky case of modeling structure, which I was alluding to in two slides ago. So if you have something like a carbon skeleton, and then the question is, okay, well, what is the relationship between an organic molecule and its skeleton? Should a skeleton be a part of the organic molecule or not? Now, its skeleton certainly is a set of entities, and it can have length and shape. Strictly speaking, it can have mass. But it turns out that biologists don't tend to associate mass with it. And we ended up choosing to model it using Has region, that organic molecule Has region skeleton, which, based on the guidelines that I showed you earlier, makes perfect sense. But certainly an organic skeleton does behave very differently than human skeleton, because if you take human skeleton, that definitely you would want to associate mass with it. This is just a tricky case, you know, where it's not obvious, you know, what do you do? Should you have a more aggregate entity, or should this skeleton be a part or a region, or what should it be? And I wouldn't say that we have fully cracked that problem and solved that problem. Our solution to that problem was just have a consistent guideline and use it the same way everywhere. And our guideline was that, well, skeletons would be considered as regions of the organic molecules. Next slide, please. Okay, so now we're going to switch to talking about functions. And just a quick time check, Leo. How much more time do I have to keep talking?
I think if we leave about a half hour for discussion, then you have about 33 minutes.
Oh, so I could go till 11, you mean?
I would say approximately.
Okay. Okay, sounds good. So then I have plenty of time. So let's talk about functions. So I think in the modeling of functions, the first question we faced was, is function a primitive or a computed notion? And as I told you earlier, we have this vocabulary for defining processes. And so on this graph, I'm showing here that every heart pumps blood, and that pumping action creates sound. And heart node here is white, so that's why it's universally quantified. Okay? Now, what we were trying to see was whether we could compute what is a function by just looking at these participant relationships, like agent and object and result. You know, we call them participant relationships. And one inference rule we could have in the system is that, if an entity is an agent of certain action, that action is a function of that entity. Now, if you try to apply that inference here, you get some strange results. You know, you, of course, the correct result would be that the function of heart is to pump blood, but you also get the inference that the function of heart is to make sound, which is quite problematic. And, you know, again, I think this becomes a lot more problematic when you look at the whole KB. Now, I just picked one example just to make the point. Basically, by looking at a lot of these examples in the KB, we reached the conclusion that Has function is really a primitive notion. And And again, I think we had to make that decision with a little bit of trepidation, because every time you introduce a new relation, your encoding time goes up, because you have to define that distinction, you have to teach your biologist, you have to do this in a consistent manner, you have to do quality assurance on it. So it's not straightforward just to, you know, randomly go and add a new relation. So go to the next slide, slide 32. So so the conclusion was that has function is cannot be a primitive notion. It has to be a primitive notion, and it has to be explicitly encoded. So in this graph, we would introduce a new edge, and we would call it has function. And every time a graph includes a function of an entity, the biologist has to explicitly encode that. So let's go to the next slide, slide 33. So let's now get into the definition of how we actually define the function. So we define function as special events in which an entity participates. And they are special because the biologist says so. And, you know, I think in the from the philosophical point of view, they say that a function is an event which is the reason for an entity's existence. Now, I mean, I think from the philosophy point of view, that's well and good, but when you start teaching start talking about entities' existence to biologists, you can get into a lot of unproductive discussion. And so we, you know, at least when we teach this to biologists, we say that, look, you know, these are special events, and these are special because the biologist says so. And a biologist gets to decide what event is a function of an entity. And, you know, that itself may be a problematic issue if you do this modeling for, say, a biomedical research type application. But for a college level biology textbook, that's pretty well defined. You know, teachers and book is usually pretty clear on what things count as function of what entities. So that definition seems to work well. But we also had to extend the definition because we make two additional distinctions which are not commonly made in the literature. So if you look at any other work on literature on functions, they won't talk about things like inherent functions and contextual functions. And I'll try to explain these two distinctions on next two slides. So let's go to the next slide. So inherent function. So inherent function of an entity is a function which is always true. And this is true regardless of where that entity appears or where that entity is used. So, for example, an inherent function of a Golgi apparatus is to store chemicals. And this is true regardless of which specific type of cell Golgi apparatus is a part of. And it makes no difference. You know, it stores chemicals. It doesn't matter where Golgi apparatus appears. And that kind of information we would state on the concept definition of Golgi apparatus. So in this case, the graph that I'm showing here, you see that the Golgi apparatus is shown in white. And that's the root node, and it's universally quantified. And this node encodes that for every Golgi apparatus, there is a function of storing chemicals. Okay, go to the next slide. Now, the contextual functions are functions which are not always true. Now, for example, one of the functions of endoplasmic reticulum is to detoxify drugs. But that function is not realized all the time. It's only realized in the context of a liver cell. Only when endoplasmic reticulum is a part of a liver cell that it detoxifies drugs. So, we would refer to that kind of function as a contextual function. And that kind of contextual function would be stated in the context of the liver cell. So here, by context, we mean what is universally quantified. And on this graph, you see that liver cell is shown in white. So liver cell is universally quantified. And smooth endoplasmic reticulum is existentially quantified, but it still has this function of detoxifying drugs, poisons, and other chemicals. So that this distinction between the inherent functions and contextual functions is something, you know, which I haven't seen made in the rest of the literature. and it's fairly unique to the kind of modeling that that we've done here. Next slide, please. Okay. So having defined function, then the next thing we had to figure out was how we were going to model the structure function relationship. So, I mean, there's always an easy case and a difficult case. An easy case is the one that you see here. So the easy case is when we know how a particular entity participates in its function. So here, detoxification is a function of smooth endoplasmic reticulum, but we know that its smooth endoplasmic reticulum is the site of detoxification. So the site relation is encoding the specific relationship the function has to the entity itself. But there are cases where such relationships are either not known or the book doesn't talk about it. So what do you do in those cases? So let's go to the next slide, slide 37. So this happens in the cases where an entity may have some substructure which participates in the function, but we don't quite know how. So an example is chlorophyll A contains porphyrin. The textbook would say that porphyrin has some role in chlorophyll A's function of absorbing light, but it doesn't tell you how. So to capture this kind of structure-function relationship, we introduced a relationship called facilitate. And again, this is a new relationship which is kind of like the Hess-function relationship, but we had to introduce a lot of trepidation because it means extra encoding, more guidelines, more quality assurance, more consistency checks, etc. So let's go to the next slide, which illustrates how this relationship is used. So this is showing the concept graph of chlorophyll A. Notice that chlorophyll A is shown in white and it's universally quantified. So chlorophyll A has part porphyrin and it has a facilitates link between light absorption. So that's one way, that's the way we would show the relationship between how the structure of chlorophyll A is facilitated a particular function. Next slide, please. Okay, so that's roughly the end of the discussion on the design of the representation for structure and function. And now I'm going to talk about our approach for answering questions. Now, like anything else in the project, our approach to answering questions could be a full one-hour talk in itself, but I've summarized here in one slide the approach to answering questions. So basically what we do is we create an A box. What that means is we take every concept in the knowledge base and we instantiate it. So there would be an individual corresponding to each concept in the KB, and if a concept had a detailed concept graph, each node in the graph would also get instantiated as an individual. So we have this whole gigantic A box that we create from the KB. Once that's created, then we reduce all the questions to conjunctive queries on that A box. So many of the queries, like what are the parts of something, what's the structure of something, what's the function of something, can be reduced to conjunctive queries on that A box. But of course, you know, not every query is a conjunctive query. There are some queries which involve finding paths. So you have this whole gigantic graph of individuals, and you have to find all the paths between two individuals. We also have some questions which involve comparing things. In particular, the questions involve computing intersection and differences between a set of triples, which, again, has some computational challenges, but also substantial user experience challenges to make the answers understandable and acceptable to the end users. Next slide, please. Okay, so this is a sample answer for the question, what is the structure of biomembrane? So here you can see that the structure is, by structure we mean all the structural slots that we've been talking about, like encloses, is between, has region, possesses, has parts, and each of those values is listed under that slot. Now, at this point, you may say that, well, you know, your structure is actually a graph, and here you are showing me a bulleted list. And you know, that would be a valid criticism. And we address that only to some degree. So, like, if for some of the things, like, for example, glycoprotein, we would show a sentence. A glycoprotein is inside a phospholipid bilayer, which, as you can see, is the item which appeared just above. So in our structured graph, this would be one of the graph edges. And some of those graph edges we render into sentences, and they would show up as part of the structure description. Next slide, please. So this shows a sample answer to the question, what are the functions of a biomembrane? And we show a summary of the functions. The summary of the functions that you're seeing here, these are what we call the inherent functions. These are the functions of biomembrane which are always true. And then underneath, we are showing the functions of different kinds of membranes. I mean, these would be contextual functions because these are function. Of course, you know, plasma membrane is a biomembrane. So any function of plasma membrane is also a function of biomembrane, but it's contextual in the sense that it's the function of a more specific plasma membrane. It's not the function of every plasma membrane. So the answer to such a high-level question would include all these functions, but we have this little drill-down capability using which you can get access to these more detailed functions. So if you click on next slide, so like if in this case, if you clicked on four functions, you will see what is shown on this slide here. All the functions of the plasma membrane would be expanded. And if you notice these last two functions of plasma membrane, the first one, the second to last one says, in receptor-mediated endocytosis, directed motion is a function. In a coated pit, transport of chemical by means of self-surface receptor is a function. So these two sentences are conveying contextual functions. The first one, the receptor-mediated endocytosis, this is a function in the context of a process because receptor-mediated endocytosis is a process. The second one, in a coated pit, is a contextual function in the context of an entity because coated pit is an entity. So the contextual functions, they can be both in the context of a process or in the context of an entity. So at the highest level, you can see that even though the question is very simple, what are the functions of biomembrane, there is quite a bit of detail in terms of both the modeling and the presentation that goes into it before the system is able to generate an answer which biologists would like. Now, you may ask, okay, well, these sentences are not very good. These sentences could be improved, and biologists won't like it. And, you know, I would tend to agree. And so if you go to the next slide, generating good sentences is a research problem in natural language generation itself. And, you know, as part of the project, we have put in a lot of work into building a fairly sophisticated natural language generation facility using which we produce these sentences. And we don't claim that our English generation is perfect, but it is what it is. And we are actually working fairly actively with the natural language generation community. We've released the KB to the community so that they can use our data to do more research on natural language generation to see how better reading sentences and maybe even paragraphs could be generated from the knowledge base, which could then become parts of the answers. Okay, let's go to next slide, slide 44. So this is an example question that queries for the relationship between structure and function. So the question is, what structure of a plasma membrane facilitates a function of a plasma membrane, namely active movement of ions? So in this case, instead of, you know, trying to produce an English sentence, we produce a graphical answer to this question. And basically the graph is saying that plasma membrane has structure electrogenic pump, and electrogenic pump has function active movement of ions. So if you read this, basically what this is saying is that active movement of ions is, sorry, the electrogenic pump is the thing which is facilitating the active movement of ions in a plasma membrane. So another point of detail I would point out here is that this graph is using a relation called Hess structure, which again is a macro relation. It's an aggregate of, you know, Hess part, Hess region, Hess possesses, and a lot of other things. And again, you know, it may be a very simple inference, but this is a relation, this is an inference that the system does using the property hierarchy in the knowledge base. And to the right here are shown the English documentation strings. These are strings which are authored by a human, which we pull from the glossary, which we include as part of the answer to help a student in better understanding the understanding the answer. Next slide, please. Okay, so here is a relationship question where the student asks, what is the structural relationship between hydrolytic enzymes and eukaryotic cell? And the system will pull out this relationship, which is basically saying that a eukaryotic cell has a part lysosome, which encloses a lysosome enzyme, which happens to be a kind of hydrolytic enzyme. And this kind of question would be answered using a graph search on the A-box. And the system would compute all relationships that it can find, then it will rank them. And in this case, instead of computing all relationships, the system would only focus on the structural slots. Only those slots which are structural would be considered for answering this question. Next slide, please. Yeah, so this is my most favorite question, the analogy question. So for the analogy question, here the question that was asked was, aquaporine is to osmosis, acetoma is to what? So to answer this question, the system will first go and look for relationships between aquaporine and osmosis. And the relationship it found was that aquaporine has the function of osmosis across aquaporine, which is a type of osmosis. And then it will go and look for a similar relationship between stoma and other things. And it finds that stoma has a function of entry of carbon in a leaf, and which is a type of transport in a plant. So the answer to this question is transport in a plant. So the system did this, path-based analogical reasoning or similarity reasoning to answer this question. Next slide, please, slide 47. Okay, so here then, I think by now I have given you a taste of the representation, some of the technical problems that we solved. I've shown you some example questions that the system can answer using that representation. Then you may ask, okay, what are some of the longer-term research problems? And I think biggest one is to define the spatial slots for the whole textbook. I mean, there is, I showed you, about half a dozen or a dozen or so structural slots that we currently use, but there are a lot of things that spatial things that the book talks about that we don't currently have in our vocabulary. Specifically, there is need to design vocabulary to encode boundaries, regions, and cavities, which comes up all over the place. And we've done some preliminary work on that in collaboration with Brandon, which is going to get published at the Conference on Spatial Information Theory in September. And I've included a link here to that paper. So if you want to read more about that, you can follow this link to see the current state of research in that area. There is also a more general problem of being able to talk about structure at multiple levels of details and from different perspectives. And that's something, we've not even started to address in any direct manner. Our system will encode structure at different levels, like, we can have structure for molecules, structure for tissues, structure for organs, etc. But right now, we really haven't done much work to see, how the structure at these different levels can be correlated, how would you answer questions that goes across different structure, et cetera. That's the wide open problem, open for novel research. Next slide, please. So I wanted to acknowledge here the work done in the ontology research community on this topic. And there are at least, you know, four lines of work which is fairly closely related to what we've done. And so I think the work by Chandrasekharan that was mostly done in the context of expert systems or AI research, they, you know, our representation, I would say, is very different from the way they do it. We were more inspired by the work by Arp and Smith. I think the function definition that we took, the starting point was, you know, what Arp and Smith had done. And the has function relationship is very similar to what Henrik Herr has developed in the context of GFO. And I would say the definition, the function definition that we are using is also quite similar to what Stefano Borgo had done for the Dolce ontology. But again, I think the work is related, but I hope many of the things that I showed here, you would agree that they go way beyond what any of these prior folks have done. Next slide, please. Okay, so now I'll talk a little bit about broader research problems, broader than structure and function. So next slide. Slide 50. So again, I think this is a slide that I showed you previously. I would say that at the highest level, you know, there are these major areas of biological knowledge. And I gave you just an example of how we dealt with structure and function. But a similar methodology, design and experimental methodology, should be applied for regulation, energy transfer, evolution, science as a process, etc. In our own work, we have already done some work to model regulation, energy transfer, and to some extent to model continuity and change. But we haven't yet spent much time looking at the remaining four core themes. And these, I think, are very interesting ontology design problems, which should be of interest to the community here. Next slide, please. When I was talking to you about the knowledge factory process, I had mentioned that one of our goals was that we wanted to catalog the modeling problems, modeling challenges that come up. And in the chart that I'm showing here, slide 51, is actually a side effect of that process. And the way this chart was generated is that as we are processing the book sentence by sentence, we look at the sentences which we are unable to encode or for which the ontology design does not yet exist. And those sentences, they get put into one of these buckets. So on the y-axis, you're seeing different ontology design buckets, like regulation, causality, cannot write the UT, or ranking, or stability, etc. And one of the complaints that I get when I show this chart is that, well, you know, some of these modeling challenges are at the sort of very specific level, like causality. You know, a lot of AI or ontology researchers would understand what we mean by causality. But when we say something like, say, inferred information or diversity or variation, you know, most people in ontology research community would immediately understand what do you mean by diversity and variation. And frequently, the challenge many times lies in taking a piece of biological information and reducing it to some known modeling approach that you could apply. And you know, we have done that work to some extent for some of the categories, like for structure and function. It took us like a long time to, you know, first see what we could really apply, which was known from the literature. And then also formulate problems like boundaries and surfaces and cavities, which we found were not as well studied or the results were not as easily available that could be directly applied. So I mean that itself takes quite a bit of work that we've done, and we have not been able to do that for all the categories that are shown here. But if any of you are interested in any of these problems, we actually have example sentences which signify or represent these problems, and you're welcome to contact us and look at some of those sample sentences to get inspiration for your research. As an example of how we have tried to get that out to the community is this. We did this deep knowledge representation challenge back in 2011, which tried to make some of those sentences available and also some sample questions available, which people can look at as samples. Next slide, please. So this slide lists challenges for ontology management. So specifically, you know, the kinds of things that people could do using KVBio101, because the data is now available, right? And there are people out there who develop techniques, but they don't develop ontologies or they don't develop content. And what we're saying here is that, look, you know, this content is now available. Could you use this content to evaluate it? You know, which parts of this are high quality? Which can be improved? Is it possible to extract an ontology of just structure from this KB? Are there any meaningful modules that you could extrapolate from this KB? Are there repeating patterns in this KB? Could you analyze this KB and tell us which kind of axiom patterns appear all over the place? Is this KB consistent? Because, you know, this huge KB and, you know, there are parts which are consistent, there are some parts which may be inconsistent, and we are aware of some of the inconsistencies. Some of the inconsistencies we have addressed, some of the inconsistencies we have not addressed. So, you know, that itself is a research problem. If somebody is working on ontology testing or debugging, they could use this data to drive their research to see if they could, for example, identify maximally consistent subsets of the KV. Okay? Next slide, please. So this is my last slide. I'm at the end of my presentation. And just as a summary, so I told you about KVBio101, which is a core component of intelligent textbook biology. We created it using state-of-the-art modeling tool Aura and the knowledge factory process. I talked to you about one aspect of the ontology design, mainly structure and function. We applied some of the already known research to the encoding, and we also developed some, you know, interesting distinctions such as inherent functions, contextual functions, facilitation, function facilitation, which are actually quite novel and have not been researched so far. And the KB is available, and we are very interested in making it we've already made it available, and we are very interested in working with the community to help forward research, specifically research on efficient reasoning with hierarchical graphs, novel conceptual modeling techniques, ontology management methods, energy methods, and of course, automated knowledge acquisition. Because, you know, there may be people out there who could say that, well, you know, there are parts of this knowledge base that we could create automatically, or we could use this knowledge base as a component of our machine reading methods or as a way to train our machine reading methods, etc. So, and, you know, there are other possibilities, other ways of using this knowledge base, which we may not have think of, and we are very interested in engaging with the community to make this maximally useful. So I'll end that, end my part on this note, and over to you, Leo.
Okay, thank you, Vinay. This is actually a very interesting talk. We'd like to open it up to questions now. So folks in the chat room, select the hand button if you'd like to make a question. I'm sure there's a lot of questions. Peter.
Hi. It was a great talk. Thank you very much, Vinay. I have several which I have documented in the chat already. Maybe I'll go backwards. from the one that I asked at Doc 56. Can you elaborate a bit more on how you arrived at the choice of components library, C-Lib as your upper ontology, and which other, for example, which other candidates did you evaluate? What criteria did you use in your evaluation, since we've been talking about evaluation?
The primary criteria was it should be easy to use by the biologists. And that was the one. And the second was that we needed a vocabulary for modeling biological processes, right? The other thing I would say is that we have looked at every other available ontology like Dolce, BFO, GFO, et cetera. We are not that different. You know, it's like we've had people from BFO come and visit us, and we've done a lot of comparisons. So it's not that different. So, and, you know, we've had some history, you know, when the project started back in 2001, 2002, none of these other resources existed. And what we have done is, over the years, is to take the best ideas from BFO and GFO and try to incorporate them into our ontology. So,
did you consider the more complex ones, like maybe Psych, Sumo?
Yeah, so I would say Psych, I would say, is not as easy to use by biologists. You know, how many biologists do you know who use Psych? And in our project, all the encoding work, KB Bio 101, it's all done by biologists. I would say 90.
So it's not knowledge engineers working with biologists, but...
Yeah, we had a very thin team of knowledge engineers, right? So we had a very thin team of knowledge engineers, but all the encoding work, testing work, evaluation work, everything is done by biologists.
Interesting.
Yeah, I did. But, you know, not just biologists, you know, the encoding, we had an encoding team located in India, and they were offshore. You know, they were not even located next to us. And we basically trained them, and they were working remotely.
Great. My other question is, actually, a couple more. Is the Inquire system self-contained, meaning you can load everything into the tablet, or does it also depend on access to other online resources?
Inquire is a client-server application. Aura is a server, and Inquire is a client app.
So when you run Inquire, you still need Aura around?
Yeah.
So online? I guess from the internet?
Yeah.
Through the internet. Okay. Great. And on slide 39, you mentioned triples. Did you sort of religiously reify everything into triples, because you obviously aren't limited to triples with relationships?
Well, so I mean, ABOX is triples, right? And we have is between, which is not the only, you know, non-triple relation we have is between. But everything else is a binary relation. And if you have an ABOX, you know, set of individuals, and you only have binary relations, you'll end up with triples. But in the non-ABOX part of the KB, you have quantifiers and you have rules, and that's not triples.
Just out of curiosity, do you happen to store your knowledge base in a triple store, or?
No, we are using KM. It's a homegrown representation system.
Thank you. Again, great talk, and thank you very much.
Let's see. Frank, Chum?
Yes. Hi, this is Frank from Chevron. I'd like to ask, is the question answering, does it recognize an open question, and how does it do it?
So, you know, as I mentioned in our talk, we don't really handle open questions. If you type an open question, the system would give reformulation advice.
Okay. Oh, cool.
And a system will give suggested alternatives.
Oh, very good. Thank you.
Harold, star 7.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can I ask a question, a technical one about equality? When we go to slide 16, you give a statistics about different knowledge features, and you mentioned you have a huge number of equality assertions.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could bring in a special treatment of equality, such as selecting some of the equivalence class as a canonical element, and then talk about this and reducing all the other ones into that representative.
Right. So, I mean, again, I think that's certainly a great problem for the research community to work on. Just to give you background, we use this representation system called KM, Knowledge Machine, and KM has a special treatment of equality built into it. And we actually have a paper on that in KR 2012. You can read about that, or you can, read up the KM user's guide. So the way these equality assertions are exported, what we did was we took the KM knowledge base and we mapped it onto first order logic with equality, right? So once that's made available as first order logic with equality, then it's for people in the research community to figure out what they would do with it. Because, we as Aura Inquire development team, we currently don't have a equality reasoner, FOL equality reasoner, right? We were using KM, which, as you point out, has a treatment of equality built into it. But that's fairly custom to KM.
Yes, I understand. Good.
Okay, Brandon, I'm not sure what your last name is, Brandon. Star 7 to unmute. Your local phone may be muted too.
What?
Yes, okay.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, yeah, it was just a question about the difference between the inherent functions and the contextual ones. I was just wondering if that requires an actual different semantics in the function relation, or whether it's just handled by the structure of the graphs that contain the function, the has function relation.
We've always thought of it as part of the structure of the graph that contains the function.
So the graph handles that for you, basically?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Actually, related to that, I had a question, Vinay. Can you consider some of those dispositions? In other words, like if you're in this kind of environment, so more of a counterfactual conditional, then you would have, or you could have, this kind of manifestation. So it's more of a conditional property.
So we had a lot of debate on that issue, and we studied BFO. Like Barry Smith's work.
Mm-hmm.
And Barry makes a distinction between a function and a functioning. Do you know what I'm talking about? Something like,
yes.
The function, something may have a function, but it may never actually realize that function.
Right.
Right. And then when they realize that function, then it becomes functioning. Which is a reasonable idea, but I think the problem we had with that idea was that if you make that distinction, then you are forced to curate two separate taxonomy. You have a taxonomy of functions and you have a isomorphic taxonomy of functionings. And it at least for the biology textbook domain, it didn't seem to, that distinction didn't seem to buy anything. And it seemed to us that while, we have to model processes are going to be modeled. And all you have to do is to just curate an extra relation which tells, which particular process happens to be a function, right? So that seemed to us like the least expensive way of curating this in the knowledge base.
I see. Okay.
So does that mean that these mean an actual function rather than a potential function, I guess?
Well, see, we don't make that distinction.
No, but they probably do, don't they, I guess, if they're in the textbook.
Yeah.
Let's see. Ji Zheng, star 7 to unmute.
What about the function and functioning? Actually, we do want to distinguish. I'm a biologist and also work on ontology. So actually, in the oval foundry, you know, there are cell, defined cell, and anatomical entities. And actually, we will say cell, if they have some function, it's defined the biological process in the gene ontology. So we're using the relation like capital of. So that means that cell or some structure, they can have that function. But we do want to say when it will realized.
Sure.
Because not everything is always realized. You know. So we do want that. And another question, have you considered about the, you know, temporal relations? So, for example, in the page 10, you define that cell has part, you know, chromosome. You know, actually, for example, for the mature red cell, it doesn't have a chromosome. So we can say that cell has a chromosome at some time, but not at all time. So I'm just wondering, do you, you know, consider this kind of stuff?
Okay, so I think there are several issues there. First of all is simply the issue of exceptions, because everything in biology has exceptions. So what do you do about that? And, you know, as you know, the way Barry Smith says that, well, exceptions are important, but ontology should be about universal truths. And you can go very far by doing universal truths.
Yeah, I know, but the thing is, we do need
it. Let me finish, and then you can respond. So, I mean, I think bulk of our effort has focused on universal truths. And, you know, that's right, like the axiom that you see on slide 10 is really, it's basically capturing a universal truth. Now, the question is, there are some situations where you do need to depart from universal truth, and we have some mechanisms for supporting that. Now, the one that you are talking about, where, say, a cell has chromosome at one point and they stop having chromosome at another point, the way we deal with that is through our, there are actually two mechanisms for dealing with that. One is simply by making that cell an object of, or making the chromosome of that cell as an object of a remove process. Because if chromosome is an object of a remove process, the semantics of the remove process will give you that once a remove process has been performed, chromosome is no longer part of the cell. Okay, so that's one mechanism that we use. The other mechanism that we use is we have this thing called a has-state relationship. So if, you know, there are, say, some spatial relationships or some structural relationships are evolving over a period of time, we would have an ability to create a copy of that entity and link multiple copies using the has-state relationship. So, like, for example, in the cell cycle, there's a point where the cell has, like, two nuclei, right? It's the same cell, but from as far as the identity criteria are concerned, but it happens to have two cells, yeah, right? So we would deal with that by creating a copy of that cell and give it two nuclei and link the two copies using a has-state relationship. Then there is a third mechanism which we can use, which works in some cases, but not in other cases. In some cases, there is some property that the biologist would state at a very general level, but taken at a very general level, that property is false. But if you state that property at a more specific level, that property is true. And that actually can be done by, you know, just reformulating your universal truth so that it applies to a more specific class and not to the more general class. Okay, so I think the final thing I should say is that obviously the real silver bullet is to have a representation language that can actually let you encode exceptions specifically. And, you know, we currently don't do that. And, you know, we've developed some of these techniques that I just shared with you, which can get you part of the way. But if you really want a full-blown solution, you have to have exceptions, and then that would make your representation language as well as the encoding effort a lot more complex.
Okay, thank you. Because that's something, because we have a lot of debate and discussion to see how to represent that, but still not really reach agreement. The temporal relation is one approach, but it will lose some transitivity property in the relation, and then it's break up the reasoning, you know. So that is hard to inform the new knowledge. So that's something. Okay, thanks a lot.
And we have the same debates here. And we have same debates here, and, you know, that's part of the ontology research that we end up doing. I think we should definitely exchange notes on what is your latest thinking on this topic.
Yeah, we have another people approach for the temporal quality.
Uh-huh.
Entity, yeah. So I think that is all the discussion going on for the, you probably know that the BFO want to move the BFO2 version.
Yeah.
So we try to implement that in all, and then we have a, you know, kind of debate, and all the, you know, Opal Foundry ontology actually using the BFO, and then for the, you know, anatomy ontology, they really don't want to move to it with the temporal relation because it will break up their database in the reasoning. So I think that interesting, we can send the document to you and then to see what's the better approach, you know, to you know, solve it.
I'll be definitely interested in looking at that. I mean, I think just to, again, you know, situate this, I mean, we look up to the Berry Smith and Company to provide us guidance on ontology design. I mean, my team here is not we don't have a lot of philosophers here, right? And we don't do as deep a thinking as Barry has done. So, you know, we read his papers and we try to learn from it and we try to use and apply as much of it as we can. And we'll continue to do so.
Okay. Got it. Another thing I would like you know that Opal Foundry ontology improve a lot, like what you mentioned, like anatomy, you know, like boundary, cavity, something like that. They already, you know, implemented using the axon. And for the cell stuff, they also implement their functions and what the, you know, proteins express there and where they located and their development. So probably you can consider to use them in the future. Thanks a lot. It's a very nice presentation.
Just following up on that, so we did look at that. And when we were doing our ontology of functions, we specifically went and spent a lot of time studying Go and how Go does its functions. And what we found was that the kind of functions that you have in Go, they are much more detailed and much more specific than what a biology textbook will talk about. So, like, most of the functions that Go would represent, you won't even find them in a textbook. And the problem with at least the textbook that we were working with was that it provides a very shallow and a broad treatment of biology. Right? So, for example, Go, I'm not sure if Go talks about photosynthesis or cellular respiration.
I think Go probably need to check both the biological process and molecular function. And I think some of high-level things that they do contain that. And
I think my understanding is Go is primarily about molecular level. It's at a molecular level, molecular function.
Right, yeah, right.
So,
right.
so So if you have to do things at any other level, you know, which textbook obviously has knowledge at the, like this, at the cell level, like the respiration and photosynthesis, I mean, that those are the things, you know, or, you know, even say you want to talk about bonds and molecules, you know, those are the things that would be outside the scope of the goal, right? And so when we actually did a, spent a fair bit of time trying to see if we could just, you know, slurp and go into our system, and that didn't seem like the right thing to do because the biology Go is focusing on seems to mismatch the biology that covers, that is covered in a Bio 101 course, right?
I see. Got it.
And again, I think the focus on Bio 101 was primarily to see if it could create a resource for AI research. And again, I think Go and a lot of the OBO Foundry work is focused at creating a resource for biomedical research, for annotation and for, you know, other kinds of things that bioinformaticians are interested in.
We also want to do that for the knowledge discovery.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's fine. And it's, I think the application is biomedical research.
Right.
And so with BioKB 101, our goal was to have a resource of knowledge which can be expected from a high school level background in biology. Right. So to understand and appreciate Go requires more than a high school background.
You're right. It's more deeper.
Biology, right?
Yeah.
So that's, I think that's, I would say, the key difference between KB Bio 101, and that's why I think it is a very interesting and compelling resource for AI research and conceptual modeling research.
Agree. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for asking.
Doug, you have a question?
Yes. On the exceptions, Vinay, have you looked into the way that psych handles exceptions? Basically, the rule is stated more generically, and then exceptions are put in, kind of, which end up actually being semantic sugar, that they're put in as a wrapper around the other rule, and inside that ends up making a more complex rule, but that's not the complex thing is not what is presented to the viewers of the rules. You just see the generic rule and with the exception on the side. So that covers these cases that you've been discussing. That we can have a much more detailed rule that will do that, and it creates that for you. So have you looked into that sort of technique?
Doug, you know, just to brag, you know, I think every representation language that's out there, most of them I've looked at, including psych. I spent a couple of years working with psych. And psych knowledge base, studying their exceptions, analyzing their exception mechanism. And I don't know if you were here last week, Benjamin Grossoff talked about rule log, and he has his own scheme for doing exceptions, right?
Right.
I mean, I think all of that is fine. You know, I know all about that. But I think this is where, you know, one area where I agree with Barry Smith on is that we currently do not have technology to efficiently write universal truths from a biology book. We cannot do that.
Right.
We don't have, it cannot be scaled on a large scale commercial level. It can be done. And so, I think the decisions we had to make was what space we were going to cover. You know, are we going to go shallow representation, broad as much as we could do, or we would make the representation very deep, regardless of, you know, how difficult it is to do. You know, you add, you know, I think we with our universal true statements and language, biologists have really tough time testing it, debugging it. You know, it takes a really long time to do it. Right. And if you add one more feature, like exceptions, it becomes even more difficult, right, to get your KB to do anything useful. So, I don't think, you know, the representation language features or expressiveness is really the issue. The real issue is, from my point of view, the real issues are in ontology design, right?
Right.
How do you take these ill-structured, ill-specified pieces of biological knowledge and reduce them to some known conceptual modeling problems? Of course, some of them will require exceptions, but bulk of them don't.
Right.
And he basically chose to focus on bulk of the problems.
Okay. One thing that when you started talking about the breadth versus the depth, one thing that can help your reasoning is contextualization, that you have the breadth out there and then you define context. And in one context, you can go deep in one narrow area. In another context, you can go deeper in a different area. But reasoning using only those ontologies, only those one context and not the other, the extra rules that are in the context you aren't using, the extra assertions that are in the context you aren't using, are not going to interfere and not going to be seen by the reasoner reasoning in one specific area.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a valid idea. I mean, I think KB partitions, I'm a big fan of partitions, you know, whether you call them context or whatever. I mean, I think that's a great idea, and it should be leveraged. It's just that we haven't done that yet. And again, I think philosophically the question really is how to think about partitions. Like when we put this technology in front of the end customer, sometimes they start saying that, oh, you know, I am asking question about chapter 2, why are you giving me information from chapter 7, right?
Right.
And so, I mean, that sort of argues for a partitioning scheme which is based on a chapter, right? There are other more extreme partitioning schemes, like you could say that, well, you know, I want a partition that talks about cellular respiration as described in chapter 9, right, which is even finer grained than you know, just having one big KB.
Right.
So I think all of those are valid, and I think they are good ideas. We just haven't experimented with those aspects so far.
Right. And my third point question was on this work came out of a HALO project. The HALO project had, I guess it was four companies working on that. So I would suggest that in prior work, you would mention each of those companies' efforts. I mean, because I don't know everybody that was in there. I know I was working on it in PsyCorps at the time on the HALO project, and that is not meant, and that effort is
so,
not mentioned in the prior work.
Again, I think that's partially fair because, you know, I didn't claim that I'm giving an overview of HALO, right?
Right.
And this is not a HALO overview presentation. Then this is the overview of the work SRI and my team did. And now, again, I think you could say that, well, you know, I mean, HALO has had a history of over 10 years and, you know, there are papers written on it, which some of which are available as part of AI Magazine. I mean, I haven't those citations, but if the comment is I should add those citations, sure. Yeah, I mean, I that's easy to do, and we can do that. Actually, there is citation to the Project HALO website on slide 2. So if you go to the Project HALO website, you know, it's their responsibility to explain everybody, right?
Okay.
And they do that.
Yes, they do.
Okay, folks, we have two more questions real quickly. We're running out of time. Let's see, Gary, star 7.
Yes.
Yes.
Hi, I have a couple questions. I wondered, after the enormous work that you put into this project that's depended a lot on manual interaction with domain experts, especially in the case of Aura, where, you know, people are doing sentence parsing. Couple things. Do you think in retrospect that you might have saved some time by using natural language processing to do some of that parsing that was done? Or did you take the path that you thought in order to get rigorous information, you're really going to require that deep manual involvement in sentence parsing.
Yeah, so I don't believe that there is any NLP technology that can reproduce what we've done manually. And in fact, you know, that's one of the challenges which I listed in the last slide. So, I mean, like, we have released what we've done. If there is an NLP technique which can automatically create that, I want to know about it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I don't. So I mean, I think just to sort of press on that a little bit further, I think the main problem is that NLP people, they change the problem. You know, they say that, well, you know, we are not actually going to create an ontological representation at the end. You know, they say, well, we'll just work with text. You know, we give me, you know, five different versions of the text and, you know, I'll do inference on those. Or give me, you know, internet scale text and we'll do inference on that, right? They change the problem. They don't really work on the problem of creating an ontologically principled representation. Mm-hmm. And if there is a technique out there which can do that, I really want to hear about it. I haven't found it.
I read some time ago about the work that was done. Where the gene ontology was reverse engineered and actually discovered new links and inferences that wasn't actually in the gene ontology. And this was done through looking at relational database and doing some natural language processing. And I just sort of thought that if, you know, that could be done with such a complex, probably in some ways not as complex as what you were trying to do. But
I think you may be missing the history here. Gene ontology originally was created as a pure vocabulary, and it was done by hand. And in RKB, we created a vocabulary, and that was pretty much done by slurping the textbook, right? So, I mean, we did that automatically using, semi-automatically. And to the extent, you know, we could use semi-automatic methods, we used. And and we're not saying that you could not enrich KB Bio 101 using some NLP techniques. Of course you could.
Right.
I'm sure, you know, there is some piece of information somewhere in the text which you could figure out, which could strengthen the KB, which could add to the KB, right?
Yeah.
Of course it can.
In a last quick question.
Folks, we're 5 minutes over. Maybe Patrick?
Thank you very much, Leo. Thank you, Leo. Dr. Chaudhry, thank you very much for your time today and your efforts. Just a quick question on licensing for Orin Inquirer. I did send a query to the email address on the webpage to Mark Rees, but it did bounce. Briefly talked to, is it available for application to other knowledge domains and the process for reaching out to you?
Absolutely. You know, just schedule a phone call and we can talk about it.
Okay. Just reach out to you, sir?
Sure. Absolutely.
All right. Great. Thanks, Leo.
Okay. Well, thanks, folks. We're a little bit over, but thank you, Vinay. We've really appreciated your talk here, and it's very interesting. And I know that there's a lot of questions that people still have. Is it okay to query you offline? Or?
Absolutely. I'd love to hear from people. I'm available to have one-on-one conversations. If you happen to be local, we can grab lunch or meet for a cup of tea, and, you know, we can talk.
Okay, great. Okay, thanks everyone for participating. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.